to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
This is the Creative Financing Podcast with Jonathan Gallegos and
Jeff Rappaport.
And welcome, guys. This is our very first episode of the Creative Financing Podcast. It is our goal here to educate you guys on creative financing in the real estate world for, you know, flippers, wholesalers, anyone trying to do any kind of deals. And so this show is just going to be an introduction of myself and Jeff Rappaport. And we're going to kind of go into our stories a little bit, how long we've been into it, when we got started, and kind of the reason why we wanted to do this podcast. And for me, Jeff, it's just been, there's not a lot of education out there on creative financing. And there's not one specific podcast out there that I can think of that is just about creative financing. How about you?
I'm super excited. I love to teach. So this is a great way that we can do that on a regular basis. And I agree with you. The information out about owner financing is certainly sparse and not always the best. So we're going to try to correct that and see what we can do to help some people all across the country.
Awesome. I love it. I'm excited for this. So a little bit about my story. I got into real estate. I guess I bought my second property and turned my primary into a rental in 2012. And then from there, I started attending the local RIAs. And in 2013, I did my first wholesale deal. It was a house just right around the corner from me. We looked up a property address just by Googling it, and it was an alternative property address from what the mailing address was. The mailing address was the same as the house, so we just sent a postcard to that address. A lady called me back and said, "Yeah, I'm interested in selling." And said, "Great." She hadn't been in the house for 2 years. It was vacant. It was in the foreclosure process, and I was like, "How would you like to avoid foreclosure? And we can pay you $500 for your time." And she's like, "That sounds great," because she already, you know, dumped the house. She moved on. She was just going to let the bank take it back, and we ended up just wholesaling it out to another local investor. But that was my first deal. Made $6,000 on that. That got me super pumped. And then we did two other deals in 2013. One for 10 grand and another one for 20 grand. So, you know, then since then I've been trying to do some wholesaling, through 14, 15, 16. And then recently, I've been trying to do some more flips because, you know, the deals have been a little scarce on my end. So I've been trying to maximize my profits by doing flips rather just than wholesaling them. So, what's your story, Jeff? When did you get started? What was your first deal? Everyone likes to kind of hear your first deal, if you have one.
Well, Jonathan, it's first of all, your story is a lot longer than that. I know that personally, so that is the absolute condensed version, but I won't be as condensed. So I started back in 1999. I actually bought my first property. And I didn't actually buy it. I lease optioned it and I sublet it. So I did a sandwich lease. I barely knew what I was doing. I did find a tenant buyer. I collected $5,000. But for some reason, something in my paperwork was a little bit sketchy. And I had a very shady seller that I was dealing with. Actually, it was like 8 college students that owned this property together. And they all quit claimed the property to one. That's who I dealt with, probably the shadiest of all. And after 1 year, he's found some kind of loophole that I had to fax something within a certain time frame, and it came, I think it was 8 minutes too late. And he contacted his attorney, who tried to strong arm me into giving back the property, or they were going to sue me.
Based on 8 minutes.
On 8 minutes, I think it was. It was less than 15, I guarantee that.
Wow. So
being brand new to all this and having some attorney intimidate me, I gave in. I ended up just walking away with the $5,000 that I made. But it taught me a valuable lesson. And a little after that, I quit my job that I was at for 9 years, and literally with no money, no savings, and really not a whole lot of education. What I started to do was find properties that I could buy subject to the mortgage, where I would actually buy the property and take over existing debt. And I was able to do quite a few of those over the next several years. And what I would do is lease option them out, collect an option deposit, a cash flow every month, make all of my tenant buyers responsible for the maintenance and repairs of the property. And then the hope was is that somewhere down the road, they would get a new loan and cash me out and pay me a third time. That really didn't happen a whole lot. I quickly learned that if you put people in on lease options and you don't either get a lot of money from them or help them get new financing, they just don't, for the most part. Yeah, I think it was like 15% that actually did go and refinance. Now, I own these properties and I had them subject to, so my term was the term of the loan. So I was in no hurry. I didn't really mind that they were not getting loans. But I did learn a valuable lesson there is that if I did want them to get a loan, I better help them through the process.
Right, right. So those people that didn't perform, did you get them out of the property?
Oh, no. I just let them keep going. And so they just continued to pay the rent. They continued to maintain the property. I mean, I had some people in houses for 10 years or more. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever done the deals where, you know, the buyer doesn't perform and then you get them out of the property, put another one in, collect another down payment?
I would do that if the term that I had was, you know, 3 years, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years. But all of these deals were, I had the length of the mortgage. So I was under no urgency to get a new loan and get existing financing cashed out. I could go, you know, 15, 20, 25 years, whatever it was. So that wasn't a big deal for me. And then as we progressed, I started to realize that even though this was a great business model, I wasn't acquiring as many properties as I would like. The option deposits were about $5,000-ish back then. And
that was good money back then.
It was good money, but I wasn't doing 2-3 of these a month. I was doing, you know, 7-8 a year. So
yeah.
I wanted more money up front. And so I started to get into short sales. Now, everyone probably understands what a short sale is these days, but when I started, I had to educate some of the banks about what a short sale was. So they didn't even know the terminology. And
yeah, that wasn't kind of a well-known term until, what, the crash of
2008? Probably by 2006. The banks knew what short sales were, maybe even 2005. But back in 2002, so much.
Which makes it a lot harder.
Actually, I'll tell you a funny story. Someone gave me a $400,000 home. It had a $140,000 second on it. And he just said, here, have it. Figure it out if you can't.
$100,000 home. It had
a $400,000 home.
Oh, $400,000.
Probably owed, I don't know, two something on the first, $140,000 second.
Okay.
This was my first experience ever dealing with a short sale.
Okay.
So my idea was I'm going to get rid of that second mortgage. So I called the bank and I said, I want you to take $0 for your $140,000. And when I look back on it, I know that they wanted to work with me.
Did they say what?
Well, so without actually coming out and saying, just make us an offer, they didn't, but they danced around stuff. And I guess I was a little dense. I just didn't get it. So ended up just holding that property for a little over a year. And I rented it out to a friend of mine for $500 a month. You know, some 6,000 square foot home.
Wow. For $500 a month?
Yeah, and I probably would have made like $150,000 on this deal. But it never dawned on me that I needed to offer them $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 for their second, which they would have taken. But
instead of nothing.
Yeah, I offered nothing.
You're so, like, here's nothing. Will you take it?
So there was a learning curve for me as well. But I started doing short sales. And now when we were able to discount the mortgage holders, release liens, you know, deal with the IRS, all of that kind of stuff, that now that the checks were 30, 40, 50,000 or more. So all of a sudden business started to really take off. And right around maybe 2004, I started to, I actually back in 2001 started the Salt Lake RIA. We're from Utah. Back then there was no meetups. There were no RIAs. I started it with another lady. Actually, it was her idea. She was, getting some mentoring on how to get into real estate. And he said, start a RIA. So we found each other and, it was just the two of us back before the internet and being able to, you know, reach out to hundreds and thousands of people. It was basically more word of mouth, and I ended up doing all the speaking probably for, I don't know, a year and a half or longer. And all of a sudden people liked coming to hear what I had to say. So the group continued to grow, and we got it to about 300 people. And, you know, meeting at libraries and community centers and anywhere we could meet that was free. And, you know, that group's still going strong today, so I'm very proud of that. Back in 2004, I started doing some education, mostly from the RIA events that people wanted more. So I started offering some classes on how to buy subject to the mortgage, owner financing, lease options, selling houses quickly. And they range from 1 day to 3 day seminars. And, I love to teach. So it was a really a great experience. The problem was we started to expand outside of Utah. We started working in Nevada. I taught a seminar there and we started a coaching program. I probably relied on people I shouldn't have relied on. And the coaching program, since our company grew so quickly, that the coaching got a little bit out of hand. They weren't teaching my principles. I had to fire them all. I had to work out everything with all my coaching students. And when that was all done, I was just exhausted. So I decided that I was going to focus more on my real estate needs and wants rather than the teaching, and kind of put that aside back in, you know, probably late 2006.
So you closed the doors on that, on the education business.
Yes.
And you just kind of got burned out because of just the lack of
management control is what I would call it. So,
okay. Yeah, I would say the lack of good people.
Certainly my fault, but relied on people that I shouldn't have relied on.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. So this was 2006?
Yes.
So you dumped the education stuff and started focusing more on lease options again? Or
no. So now it was short sales and subject to the mortgage. And then back in like 2005, maybe 2004, I started doing some rehabbing. And the rehabbing business started to grow where it wasn't just your, you know, median house price range. It started getting into the luxury market, the higher end type properties. And then I branched out into a little bit of everything. And the biggest deal was someone that I had, that I knew had some land here locally under contract. It was 55 acres and right in the middle of development all around it. And
that's a big lot, 55 acres.
It was, yeah. And he had $250,000 non-refundable earnest money.
Of yours?
His.
Okay.
In the deal, and he was about to lose it. So
you were kind of partnering with this guy?
So he brought me in. I turned things around. I got us a couple of different hard money loans. And it took about a year, but we flipped it, and we made about $2.1 million.
Wow. Flipping that land. You got to go a little more into that. That's that's too much money to make and not give us any kind of detail on that.
So it was in a city called Midway here in Utah, which is more of like a it was like a country area, but it was becoming a lot more touristy. And it was up on this hill, and literally there was development all around it. It was like this big patch right in the middle. So
yeah.
You knew that there was some demand for it. But I had never done any land. The guy that I worked with certainly had never done any land.
And Midway's close to Park City, right?
Correct.
It's pretty close to Park City. So anyone that knows Utah probably knows Park City.
Yes.
As a ski destination. They also hold the Sundance Film Festival up there every year. So anyway, sorry, go ahead.
So what the goal was is that we were going to we were going to get the lots entitled. We were going to subdivide it and deal with all the lots. But all of a sudden we realized that it costs a lot of money to subdivide 55 acres. And we already had really high-priced hard money involved. And we were working with the previous seller to, you know, we had to deal with architectural plans and and everyone just kept wanting checks, and it's like
the city. You had to get city approval. Everything.
Well, we never got to that point because once all the demands for money started to roll in, we decided that wasn't the route we wanted to go. I wish we would have, because we would have made a ton more money. But
if you had hard money, right? I mean, clock's ticking at that.
And this wasn't, this isn't like hard money rates right now. This was like 5 points and 18% interest on 4 point something million dollars. So
that's huge.
This wasn't cheap money by any means. And then extension fees, when you're talking extensions with that kind of hard money, it was at least $100,000, if not several hundred thousands of dollars. So,
wow.
So we decided to just try to find a new buyer to take over what we were doing, because we got a good price on it. Things were, you know, back in 2006, were seven. Things were really increasing in value. So this was a pretty sought after piece. But it took us like a year until we found a buyer, ended up selling it for 7 point something million dollars. And cash. So,
cash.
This hard money lender did all right, because if I, and I'm not positive of this, but made a loan to us. We paid several extension fees. He made a lot of money on us. Sold the property. He relent money to the new buyer.
Uh-huh.
And then I believe the new buyer failed. And the hard money lender got it back and resold it to someone who ended up developing it.
Wow. So he made a killing on it. He did
probably,
the best out of all of you guys.
Yeah, he probably doubled or more his money involved. So, but we did all right. And so that was probably the best and worst thing that could have happened to me. So,
okay, interesting.
One is that we had to go through a lot of stuff, a lot of stress. A lot of pressure, but when it was all said and done, we had a lot of money and liquid, and you know, the market was really good back then. So what we had to do was get a little more creative in terms of finding deals. So things were appreciating so much, I was buying like high-end properties at maybe 20% discount that I could go rehab, update, and by the time we were done, we could sell it for, you know, 30% more than what we bought it for. So
because of the market appreciation.
Correct.
Okay.
So so we were doing maybe 7 or 8 and higher end, so between 500,000 and maybe $1 million houses, you know, $150,000-$200,000 renovations. And then I bought a subdivision in Orem, which is, you know, just outside of Salt Lake County, Utah County. Yeah. And the goal was is we were going to build townhomes until I started looking into what it was going to entail. And I thought, nah, I don't want to do that. It sounds like too much work. So I realized that I had bought the lots at a really good price. I had bought them at $80,000 a piece. And I could sell them right now without doing anything for about $120,000.
Now, were they entitled already, the lots?
Yes, they were so actually lots, ready to be built.
So you bought the lots from another investor?
A developer.
From a developer.
Okay. Yeah.
So was it just like, oh, I got too many of these, I need to offload some of them?
I think that they had taken it, they didn't really want to build it, and they had their hands in a number of projects, so they were willing to let this one go. This was right on a golf course.
Okay.
So why they sold it to me for the price that they did, I'm not sure. Maybe they knew a crash was coming, decided it was time to get out quickly. I really don't know, but
okay.
I do know that I found a buyer, a builder, that was buying them from me for $120,000 a piece. So
you got them for about 80, and you're selling them for about 120 a piece.
Yeah, so there was a realtor involved, and yeah, you know, so I wasn't making 40, but yeah. You know, it was a good profit.
Yeah, good deal.
Problem was we had hard money on this deal as well. And again, keep in mind that, you know, 4-point-something million purchase price with, you know, a number of points up front and probably 15 to 18% interest.
Yeah, that adds up real fast.
Yeah. And so my buyer was buying 4 lots at a time. So
okay.
It was taking a while. And
so you're like, come on.
Yeah. So he was,
hurry up.
He was killing me as far as hard money, but that's when the crash occurred. So he had taken out 32 lots. So I had yet really, every time he was just paying loan. I wasn't making any money at this point, but, all of a sudden, the crash came, and these lots that we were selling for $120,000, I couldn't sell for $55,000.
Oh, wow.
I say $55,000 because I tried. So it didn't happen. And so my hard money lender ended up taking back the lots. I really didn't make any money from it.
So you became the motivated seller.
Very motivated. And seriously, if the crash would have held out maybe another 5, 6, 7 months. I would have been out of everything that I was doing. These lots would have been done. The high-end properties would have been done. And then right then, also, all of my homes, you know, were getting done and we were putting on the market and, you know, selling for, you know, high fives to $1.5 million. And there were no buyers. The crash had now created all kinds of issues for people that were borrowing money, and values were dropping. And so I was left with all the high-end properties and this subdivision. And I probably went about things the wrong way. Rather than looking at the opportunity that was presenting itself, I was trying to protect all of my investors, all of the properties that I had. So I just kept feeding all of these things to try to keep them above water until I didn't have any more money and ended up losing all of them. And
So all your flips you had going, they all went back to the hard money guys?
They went back. So back then, it was so easy to get bank loans that I had gotten bank loans on all of the flips. So, you know, stated income, didn't care what you actually made as long as you had a pulse. And, you know, The option arms where you could choose to just pay interest only if you wanted. So these were all great deals for you if you were holding stuff short term. But now all of a sudden all these properties went through foreclosure and I lost them all. So over the course of several years and we played the foreclosure game to extend the life of all of these properties as long as possible. But over the course of maybe several years, I ended up losing it all. And now I had no money because I literally used all of my money to try to protect all of the assets that I had. So some different chain of events occurred. All of a sudden, I was married and living in a 6,000+ square foot home, and my wife didn't like what was going on, so she decided she wanted a divorce. Our own house was being foreclosed on, and literally I was like, I had nowhere to go. I actually moved in with a friend of mine for 30 days on one of my houses that was in the foreclosure process that he was living in because, he had nowhere to go.
You're like, hey, dude, can I move in?
To my own house that neither of us are paying for right now. Yeah. So it wasn't a great situation. Over the course of a couple of years, I was completely out of real estate. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure how I made it so that I wasn't homeless. I literally had no income. I had no savings. And I don't know if you've ever tried to get a job when you've been out of the job market for 10+ years, but no one really wants to hire you.
Yeah,
and it doesn't even matter for how much.
Right. They see this gap of unemployment there and they get scared of that.
People tell you that, oh, you wouldn't like this job. I'm like, I would like any job that would pay me right now. So, they were always afraid that I wouldn't do well taking orders. I was always the boss, that I would take something better as soon as it came along, which they were absolutely right. But I needed income, and I really couldn't get it. So it wasn't until I actually got a job working at a telemarketing company selling timeshare credits over the phone, which I know what you're thinking, and you are right. It is not a fun job.
Yeah.
The training was really poor, and they pay you $12 an hour for 2 months, and then they expect that you will start making enough commission to replace it. Wow. Well, the learning curve really on that type of job is more like 5 or 6 months. And even the most successful people there weren't really making money until month 4 or 5. Well, I couldn't survive after 2 months. So I did the training and the calls. I went through the motions for 2 months. But once that salary was taken away, it was like, I'm done. I can't wait to get any more money. But I had met someone while I was working there and we became really good friends. Then we ended up in a relationship, and I think for the first time in a number of years, she motivated me to want to do something again. So
okay.
I decided that looking for a job and working for $10, $15 an hour or whatever it was going to be was a total waste, that I have some knowledge and experience. I should be back in real estate. And
absolutely.
So I started again, completely from scratch. And literally this time I didn't have that. It was no money. It was less than no money. So, I actually went back to a couple of investors that I had worked with and they lent me a little bit of money to get going. And I started in wholesaling, which was totally different from what I had done previously,
right.
But I needed money and money quickly, and that's where I wanted to focus. So as I started getting back into real estate and re-educating myself, because, hey, some things certainly change in real estate after you've been out for a few years.
Yeah, and, pretty quick.
Yeah, you know, back in 2006, our main way of doing marketing was direct mail and ads in the newspaper.
Yep.
I literally had probably just gotten a website maybe in 2005 or 2006. Now it's like, you better be have an online presence. And I'm not sure the ads in the newspaper are the best way to go anymore. But have started back. It's been about 3.5 years. Still building our business. We now have 5 people, a part of our company, Jupiter Property Solutions. And you know, our goals are to do about $2.5 million this year, 2018. And one of the things that's happened, which is kind of the reason for this podcast, is that right now everything is very competitive. The market is appreciating. There's lack of inventory. And everyone and their mom, their dad, and their dog want to be in real estate.
Yes.
And typically the easiest barrier of entry is either wholesaling or rehabbing. Too many reality TV shows. So the competition made it difficult for us to get as many deals as we would like. So I went back to what I had learned many years ago, and that is how to start using creative financing to either wholesale or own ourselves. And that's kind of our niche. That's what's kind of set us apart.
Yes.
And that's the whole reason, and you know, maybe I can share a little history between the two of us, is that I met you probably at the very first RIA luncheon that I went to, and they asked me to speak for 30 minutes or something. I'm not sure why, because you know, she remembered me from 10 plus years ago is why.
We make wins.
Right. And I must have said something that that attracted you to me, because you came up to me after and said, I could use a mentor. I'm like, I don't know really what that would even entail.
Right.
And so we started a relationship. I quickly realized that you are very technologically advanced compared to I am. So rather than doing some kind of monetary thing, we did some kind of trade thing.
Right.
And so we've developed a relationship over a number of years. And we tend to meet at a coffee place and catch up every so often. And more often than not, we're talking about some kind of creative financing.
Yes.
And that's what we decided is, we want to now take the coffee shop conversations that we were having and
make them into a podcast.
Correct.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm glad you went into that story, because for me, I've always just learned so much listening to you and how you've done deals, how you've structured deals. You're just a wealth of knowledge. You have so much experience, and really, you have an incredible story, because you went, you know, you did some huge deals, and then you lost everything, and now you're rebuilding, and you've done well for yourself so far. And, you know, I still call you anytime I have any kind of question. So I'm glad you went into that story, because you have been a huge mentor for me in my business. And I still deem myself as a newbie in this game, just because there's so much to learn in real estate. There's so many facets and, you know, niches. And one thing I found was really cool that you do is you wholesale these creative financing deals. And I don't know anyone else in this market that really structures terms the way you do. And it's pretty unique. And there are some profits that you uncover that, you know, that a cash guy couldn't get. You know, a guy coming in with cash couldn't do, but you you kind of, you know, you put these deals together in a way that you unlock hidden profits, you know. And I say that because they would be hidden to a guy like me that just doesn't know otherwise. So I wanted to start this podcast to you know, continue my education on learning creative financing, because it's you know, there's so much there to learn, and it's so technical in a lot of ways. And you just have so much experience. And so I'm glad you mentioned that story. And so for me, doing this podcast, I'm still learning from you, and I'm still trying to learn these creative financing solutions. And Anything I bring up to you, any kind of deal scenario, and you just you know a solution for it. And so I wanted to leverage that and you know share that with other people here on the podcast. And a lot of this will be me, you know, just asking you, how would you do this? Or, you know, what did you do in that scenario? And what we'd like to do is set up a hotline so we can have people call in and ask questions about creative financing, specifically on how to structure some kind of deal. So hopefully after we kind of lay the foundation of our first couple episodes here, we can set up a hotline and start answering questions for people, because we'd love to engage our audience and get them involved in this.
Well, and I certainly appreciate that. I'm not sure that I consider myself an expert, but I have been around long enough, and I've had a lot of education, starting way back in 1999, and I maintain my education to this day. So,
and the term expert is just relative, right?
Correct. I do know how to structure financing deals, and I do it sort of differently than others. I've had the opportunity to work with some people that really understand owner financing. And by the way, this isn't something new.
Right.
This isn't the newest and coolest thing now.
Yeah.
This has been going on for many, many, many years.
It was probably more popular when you got in doing that than now. You know, flipping and wholesaling is the most popular strategy now, as opposed to kind of what you were doing back then. I'm assuming.
To be honest, and you know, I will certainly talk about some different mentors that I've had. We'll try to actually get them on our podcast so we can interview them. But the main guy that really had a lot to do with my education was Ron LeGrand. And Ron LeGrand taught all of it. So he taught owner financing. He taught wholesaling. He taught rehabbing. And you know, I was doing subject to deals back in 2000. I can tell you Ron LeGrand was doing owner financing back decades, 10 decades plus ago. Years prior to that. So what we're doing now is not anything new. There might be some different nuances to them, but owner financing is not going away. So, and when I say owner finance, creative financing, because I'd like to make sure that we include lease options, that kind of thing. So,
right. And we're going to get into that later on. I think the next couple episodes, we're going to go into the different strategies and kind of lay down the basics of each strategy. And that's going to be on our next podcast. Thanks, Jeff, for giving us your background story. It really is amazing how much you've done, how much you've lost, and now your journey of rebuilding that. And for me, I got started in 2013, so I'm still kind of new. I haven't experienced any kind of major loss.
I would try to keep it that way.
Yeah. Thank you. And really, the market cycle. So I would say that I still haven't experienced a full market cycle myself, which you have. So that's great. This is, we went longer on this one than you thought we would. We're about 38 minutes
right now.
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
So, guys, we're going to wrap this up. Hope you've enjoyed this, and we're going to just dive in deeper here to creative financing. Like I said, Jeff's a wealth of knowledge when it comes to this subject, and so I'm really going to be trying to pull that out of him and kind of learn any and everything we can from him. So Jeff, any final words?
Super excited. Can't wait to really get into this and into the more detailed aspect, structuring deals and why you'd want to do it certain ways. So I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Guys, tune in for the next episode. This is episode 000. And again, this was just our introduction story. So our next episode, we're going to do the basics, right?
We're going to go over what different types of creative financing is out there and why you would want to use certain ones in certain situations.
Great. So tune in, guys. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.